From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. You've made it. It's Friday. Sarah Perry here, filling in for Tony Perkins again this week, Director of Partnerships, and I can't wait to talk to our guest tonight. We have lots on tap, but let me start off with some good news out of, surprisingly, the Ninth Circuit. We covered earlier on Wednesday hearings in the House administration, House on the Trump administration's change in the use and administration of those Title 10 family planning funds. And just yesterday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals delivered a huge setback to Planned Parenthood by lifting injunctions on the Trump administration's rule prohibiting Title 10 family planning funds for facilities that perform or support abortions. So the executive action will actually take effect now while other appeals are pending. So good news to start, but for today's show, millions of people in Hong Kong, many of them Christians, have spilled out into the streets for 10 straight days, protesting a possible extradition bill, which would be an excuse to pick up anyone from Hong Kong and detain them in mainland China that is known for its rampant human rights abuses. They're all singing the same hymn. Bob Fu, founder of China Aid, who was one of the young protesters present at the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, will join me. In my second segment, Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill joins me to react to the misguided accusations from the one and only discredited Southern Poverty Law Center about voting issues in his state. At the bottom of the hour, a pastor and school board member in Appleton, Wisconsin, is in hot water for mentioning Jesus in a graduation speech. Not only do I have a soundbite from the speech, but I have the pastor himself. And at my last block, a heartbreaking topic. Boys as young as 10 are being sold into the sex trade, dressed as girls, and shipped across the U.S. I will talk with Jeff Rogers, the co-founder of the U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking, about their home for boys and young men whom they've pulled out of the sex trafficking world. A reminder, TonyPerkins.com is the podcast website where you can find information on our guests and resources. Follow me on Twitter at Sarah P. Perry or Tony at T. Perkins. And as I've reminded you this week, let me say again, we are approaching the end of our fiscal year and we need your help to maintain the momentum we have for faith, family, and freedom. We are challenging our listeners to help us match $25,000 in challenge funds, which doubles your gift dollar for dollar. With so much on the line for the principles and the American liberties that we hold dear, please call our phone bank, 1-800-225-4008, to help FRC remain standing strong as your voice in Washington, D.C., 1-800-225-4008. Well, we noted earlier this week in the Washington Update that in downtown Hong Kong, it is a startling, memorable visual with an even more surprising soundtrack. A mass of humanity, which some experts are saying is upwards of 2 million people over the weekend, is packing the streets, and it is ongoing. It's the latest sign that the protests against China's extradition law are in no way dying down. And if anything, they are growing and taking on a spiritual component. The strains of Sing Hallelujah to the Lord started over the weekend with a group of Catholic students, and soon the entire crowd joined in, turning one of the territory's largest demonstrations in history into an impromptu worship service. 19-year-old Edwin Chow said this was the one people picked up, as it is easy for people to follow with a simple message and an easy melody. It also shows that this is a peaceful protest. Listen to them sing in the soundbite we have.
Sing hallelujah to the Lord. Sing hallelujah to the Lord.
Sing hallelujah to the Lord. Sing hallelujah.
For the past week, this hymn has been heard almost nonstop at the main protest site. Isn't that incredible? Right in front of the city's legislature and at marches and even at tent standoffs with the police. As these echoes are going through the streets, up and down, waves of voices, a lot of Christians can't help but think that it's a poignant reminder of what's at stake. On Wednesday last week, police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowds, and one protest placard afterwards said, "Stop shooting or else we sing hallelujah to the Lord." Boy, I love the stories of people who are braver than me because, man, I hope I wake up one day and have this kind of bravery. Joining me to talk further about what's at stake in Hong Kong today is Bob Fu, president of China Aid, who was also a student leader during the Tiananmen Square demonstrations for freedom and democracy in 1989. Bob, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me.
Bob, I am so excited to talk about this, and it is such an issue that I feel passionately about as somebody who, like a lot of our listeners, is committed to the notion of human freedoms, the freedoms that we have as Americans we take for granted, and yet here individuals in Hong Kong have remained for the better part of 10 days protesting the government of a nation that is so committed to its opposition to those freedoms. So talk to me a little bit about this extradition law and what it would do if it's passed.
Yes, Sarah. What triggered this massive protest is this extradition law, as you just mentioned. In 1987, when the former Communist Party leader Deng Xiaoping signed this treaty of transfer Hong Kong from the United Kingdom to China from then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and there is a guarantee. It's called One Country, Two System, in which Hong Kong was guaranteed to maintain its capitalist marketing a driven system with a very unique a guarantee for judicial independence for 50 years since the handover from 1997. Yet the Communist Party is hurrying up to make the one country, two system into a one country, one system. That means the Chinese Communist system. So this extradition law is basically the last step to make Hong Kong lose its judicial independence. Under this extradition law, basically nobody will be safe. Even those who pass by, drop by Hong Kong as an international business center, you know, could be subject for extradition if the Chinese Communist Party deemed as a national security threat, as a religious threat, any political threats, any threat. So Hong Kong already produced many political prisoner of conscience, including a number of Christians who organized the Umbrella Movement, so you remember a few years ago, had been all imprisoned, including pastors, including the Christian law school professors. They're now all sentenced to imprisonment. And, of course, the young leader Joshua Huang, who is himself is a very dedicated Christian, was imprisoned and was just released a couple of days ago, right after the second protest with 2 million Hongkongese took to the street. So that is at stake, whether Hong Kong will remain at least a minimum judicial independence or it will subject to the total control of the Chinese Communist Party's arbitrary legal system where there is no independence at all. So in the past few years, we have seen hundreds of thousands of churches were being banned and thousands were being destroyed. And many of those pastors were even being imprisoned. Over 300 lawyers, human rights lawyers, were being detained and imprisoned, and some are still in prison. So there is no judicial independence in mainland China. So if this extradition law is passed, basically this means the death of this Hong Kong judicial independence and the one country, two systems promise.
I don't think many Americans understand truly what's at stake here. So thank you for such an excellent explanation. And let me ask you, because we only have a few minutes, talk to me a little bit about the hostility in China, specifically toward Christians, which have, surprisingly, a massive population presence, upward of 100 million in China. But China is extremely hostile to Christianity, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Sarah. You are right on this point. Last year marked the worst year in 40 years since the Cultural Revolution, that the persecution against the Christians and other religious minorities under this brutal dictator, President Xi Jinping. And basically, in the name of so-called sanification, sanitization, which means like falsification. This means anything that is not under the Communist Party control will be regarded as non-Chinese and subject for severe persecution. And right now, last year, according to our own documentation, at least over 1 million Christians had been subject to severe persecution. Over 100,000 Christians were being detained or imprisoned. Among them, at least 50,000 were physically and mentally abused and tortured. There, for the first time in 40 years, we have seen the Communist Party organize a massive campaign to ban all children, all students at school, all teachers, all medical professionals from even have a committed Christian belief, and the children were all forced to sign a form to renounce their faith. And even the Communist Party tried to change the Ten Commandments into Nine Commandments because the First Commandment was deemed as offensive to Communist Party leader Xi Jinping. So that is happening right now. But as you just showed in Hong Kong, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Mm. So sing hallelujah to the Lord.
Bob Fu has been my excellent guest. Well, Carrie Lam, who is the Beijing-backed leader, has postponed the introduction. We are watching this very carefully. If you are interested in more information on ways to help, go to ChinaAid.org. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, I have Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill, who'll join me to refute the SPLC's claim about voting rights in his state. We'll be right back.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
If you're like me, you care about the future of our country. Now more than ever, it is vital that we stand up for biblical values. This year, you can. Come to the annual Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on October 11th through the 13th and join thousands of Americans like you who want to change the culture so that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. This year, we're calling on Americans to pray, to vote, and to stand firm as we fight back to win the culture. Invited and confirmed speakers include Dana Lesh, Sebastian Gorka, Bill Bennett, Laura Ingraham, and Reverend Franklin Graham. Now is the time to stand for truth. There will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a biblical worldview on issues like religious liberty, the LGBT movement, the sanctity of life, the realities of socialism, and more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, and I'm filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Nancy Abudu, the Deputy Legal Director of Voting Rights from the discredited Southern Poverty Law Center, wrote an op-ed Monday in the Montgomery Advertiser slamming Alabama's voter laws. Well, my next guest, Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill, has something to say in the face of what he believes is a terribly inaccurate piece. Secretary Merrill, so glad to have you here on Washington Watch.
You are so nice to have me as your guest, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to be with you today.
Well, I would love to give some airtime to your excellent and well-worded response to Ms. Abudu. And let me start by saying, as a primer for those who are not familiar with the organization itself, this is an organization that was once a vaunted civil rights king that was in charge of financially breaking the back of the Klan, and then there was significant mission creep, so much significant mission creep that organizations like FRC, Alliance Defending Freedom, American Family Association, think tanks, lawyers, individuals with disparate perspectives from the SPLC are now listed alongside the KKK and neo-Nazis. So recently, the SPLC went through a sea change. There were accusations of racism and sexism, and so they have hired many, many African-American women. And their new voting rights organization has been headed up by none other than Miss Abudu. So she claimed that the SPLC's new voting rights team would challenge rights and practices that suppress the votes of minority and young voters, accusing, Mr. Merrill, your organization, your office, your state, with having participated in efforts to discourage voters. How do you respond?
Well, you know, she's entitled to her own opinion, but she's not entitled to her own facts. So what are the facts? Facts are that we've made a concerted effort since I became the Secretary of State on January the 19th, 2015, which is 4 years, 5 months, and 2 days ago, to ensure that each and every eligible U.S. citizen that's a resident of Alabama is registered to vote and has a photo ID. We travel to all 67 counties at least one time every year. We go to festivals, events, and activities that are scheduled throughout the state on multiple occasions, And we have the Board of Registrar's office that's open each and every day. The courthouse is open in every county in the state. And we ensure that we provide a photo ID or the opportunity to register to vote for any citizen that wishes to register that is qualified to do so. We've also created a mobile application for the phone, so you can register to vote on the computer or on your phone as long as you have a valid Alabama driver's license. We promoted voter registration and photo ID delivery by using some of the most prominent Alabamians in our state, including Alabama head football coach Nick Saban, Auburn University head football coach Gus Malzahn, and a variety of other people whom many of your listeners would know of. However, bottom line question should be, with all that you've done, what does that really mean and how is it impacting what has occurred? Since January the 19th, 2015, we have registered 1,278,824 new voters. 1,278,824 new voters. We now have a state record, 3,491,599 registered voters in Alabama. Those numbers are unprecedented and unparalleled in the history of our state. But when you compare them per capita to every other state in the union, we surpass every other state in the union when it comes to voter registration and photo ID delivery, if that's their law. You also need to know that we've removed more than 780,000 people from the voter rolls because those people have moved away, they passed away, or they've been put away. And whenever that happens, they need to come off the voter rolls. Now, the other thing that you need to know is that voter registration is good, but voter participation is better. And in the last four major elections in our state, we've broken every record in the history of the state for voter participation. And not one time in those elections, March 1, 2016, when we had 1.25 million Alabamians go to the polls in the presidential primary, November the 8th of that year, when President Trump was elected, 2.1 million Alabamians went to the polls. December the 12th, 2017, in the special U.S. Senate election, 1.3 million Alabamians went to the polls. And last November on the 6th, 1.7 million Alabamians went to the polls, shattering the state record by more than 500,000 voters. Not one time has one person ever been denied access to vote because they didn't have a qualified government-issued photo ID.
Wow. Not only has Alabama presented accurate data by cleaning up their records, by motivating voters, by providing services, it has actually hit a new record in terms of voter participation. So let me say quickly, in the time that we have left, because the SPLC loves to imagine ascendant fascism and racism around every corner, let's talk about the minorities in your state. Let's talk about how many African Americans are registered to vote.
Oh, yeah. Let me do that, my friend. 96% of all eligible African Americans in the state of Alabama are registered to vote. 91% of all eligible Caucasian Alabamians are registered to vote. And 94% of our entire state population that's eligible to vote is registered to vote. So there's no argument about what we're doing. And the narrative that the liberals continue to push is really unimaginable, because when you look at the empirical data, it does not align with their reasoning and their logic. So I'm always delighted to share our story about what we're doing, which is why I've been invited to go to Congress twice this year to testify about the great work we're doing. And ask yourself this question as we exit. When's the last time you knew that Alabama had been invited to Congress to talk about the great work they're doing in voter registration and election participation?
Oh, let me tell you, Secretary Merrill, this has been a fabulous interview and an option to set the record straight. Thank you for everything you do for our constituents in the great state of Alabama, and thank you for coming on Washington Watch. Well, coming up next, we have some more PC speech policing. A pastor in the state of my homegrown Wisconsin was in hot water for mentioning God during a graduation speech. I'll have Pastor Alan Dupree coming up next.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleason, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch on this Friday edition. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, as most pastors we would imagine do, Pastor Alvin Dupree loves God, and it's not that much of a secret around Appleton, Wisconsin. But let me tell you what happened when he went to give a high school graduation speech. He does, by the way, serve currently on the Board of Education, in addition to pastoring his local church. His campaign platform, by the way, was he was a man of God first, and he would stand for Christian values. So he made a promise, and he kept it. When Pastor Dupree was invited to deliver the commencement at North High School, it shouldn't have surprised anyone when he mentioned his relationship with Jesus. Let's listen to what he said.
Whatever your source of strength is, you lean on it. Never let anyone make you hide it. For me, my source of strength is my faith, my relationship with Jesus Christ.
As his speech came to a close, a school board member and Pastor Dupree edited his script. Let's listen to the change he made.
It's my pleasure to commend each of you for your achievement and to publicly and formally accept the Appleton North High School. Now, it was typed out to say best wishes, but I'm changing their script to what I would say, God bless.
Oh, I love it. Pastor Alvin Dupree joins us now on Washington Watch. Pastor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, thank you for your gutsy campaign commitment that you would be a man of God first. So these individuals, when they invited you to come speak, they had to know a little bit what they were getting in inviting a pastor, didn't they?
Absolutely. I've made it no secret that I am first and foremost a man of God. Although I happen to be an African-American man and the first elected black man on the Appleton School Board, I made it clear that I am a man of God first.
Now, what kind of feedback did you get from the students and the parents after your speech?
Well, right after my speech, having shook hands of the class with close to 500, I can tell you very accurately, over 100 of them, when shaking my hand, said, thank you for that. God bless you. And upon the graduation and actually finishing up of the shaking hands, over 300+ individuals surrounded around me talking about thank you for the ability to speak publicly. As an elected official, it really encouraged us as we move forward in life. This, however, situation did not come as a surprise to me because, as it was in 2017, the Freedom From Religion organization came at me because I said similar things at the graduation ceremony back then. However, there was no recording of it, so there was a null and void for them to try to attack me because they couldn't see the actual recording. Well, this time around, I believe there was some intentionality from this Freedom from Religion organization, having had individuals contacted to, once I got up there, to hope that I would say what I say to try to bring forth this crazy, intolerant behavior to try to silence people of faith.
Well, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, this Wisconsin-based organization, and I was raised in Wisconsin. I know them well. Obviously had a bone to pick because now there's proof of the fact that you mentioned your relationship with Jesus and you told them God bless. So what are they asking happened to you after this graduation speech?
Well, clearly, the letter that they provided, and I say that I believe this was intentionality, the letter that they provided, it very much is similar to the letter that allegedly the students wrote, which was drafted up by a parent who I believe in part had a lot to do with conspiring and, to me, coercing these kids to draft up this letter or actually endorse this letter. The letters indicate they want the school district to come up with policy to ensure that every speech is censored and filtered of anything referencing any part of faith at all, and that specifically that I am not asked to speak at any other graduation or any other school-endorsed event because they feel that I was trying to force my beliefs on them. And if you listen to the speech, I clearly stated that my source of strength is my faith and my relationship with Jesus Christ, and I went on to state, whatever your source of strength is, you need to find it and don't hide it. Be you, no matter where you go, be you. And don't be bullied by people who will try to make you conform to their norm or feel the pressure of being politically correct and invent, don't be who you were created to be. So this is clearly just an attack and a very strategic one. I will highlight very briefly that it was also a distraction tactic to try to take the attention away from a truancy court issue in which I made it clear that it was my faith that made me speak up on a system that had been used and abused, denying kids due process and locking kids up for silly things such as truancy without truly dealing with the underlying issues. And because I did that, and if you Google Apple Genera School District and truancy court, you'll see all the coverage on that scandal. This was attacked because on the board, I would not be silent on an issue that was addressing and hurting our kids.
Well, let me say, I know you are a military veteran. Your father served in the Army. Your daughter serves in the Army. Your wife served in the Navy. So it has to be strange to feel like you're fighting this battle all over again. But boy, we are so grateful you are. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, a difficult but necessary topic. Boys as young as 10 sold into sex trade, dressed up as girls, shipped across the United States. I'll talk with Jeff Rogers, the co-founder of the U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking, next.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
If you're like me, you care about the future of our country. Now more than ever, it is vital that we stand up for biblical values. This year, you can. Come to the annual Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on October 11th through the 13th and join thousands of Americans like you who want to change the culture so that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. This year, we're calling on Americans to pray, to vote, and to stand firm as we fight back to win the culture. Invited and confirmed speakers include Dana Lesh, Sebastian Gorka, Bill Bennett, Laura Ingraham, and Reverend Franklin Graham. Now is the time to stand for truth. There will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a biblical worldview on issues like religious liberty, the LGBT movement, the sanctity of life, the realities of socialism, and more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It's Friday. You've made it. We both have. Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins here. Before I get to my final guest, I want to take another chance to remind you that we are coming to the close of our fiscal year. As a nonprofit, we rely on your generosity and your donations to keep standing for your beliefs in Washington, D.C., and the landscape has never been more hostile. We are challenging our listeners to a $25,000 match fund, doubling your gift dollar for dollar. So with so much on the line for faith, family, and freedom, please call 1-800-225-4008. Help us remain standing strong as your voice, your representatives in Washington, D.C. That's 800-225-4008. A growing number of young males, some just 10 years old, are being forced into the sex trade in the U.S. Traffickers are even dressing some little boys as girls before selling them. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo gave a speech yesterday in D.C. here to honor sex trafficking survivors and to speak on the newly released Trafficking in Persons report. Pompeo said the report showed some alarming results. Let's listen.
Our report reveals the grim reality. There are 25 million adults and children suffering from labor and sex trafficking all over the world, including in the United States, and indeed in this very city in which we're sitting here today.
And indeed, it is not just a risk for people traveling to a foreign country. Pompeo said that every nation must be vigilant to the problem inside their own borders. Let's listen.
Because in reality, sex traffickers exploit an estimated 77% of victims in their own home country.
The FBI then shared a video from August 29th, 2018, of an anonymous survivor of sex trafficking. This young woman describes how she came under the control of David DeLay, who was sentenced in April 2018 in Seattle for sex trafficking and child pornography. Here she is.
He said that I would make $20 million from the documentary and that it was, if porn was legal, then escorting and prostitution should be legal too. At first, they treated me very well. David bought me things and bought coffee and just treated me like a friend, I should say. I think I was kind of just in shock and I didn't really know what to think of it. And I just wanted to be cared about, and I wanted a person to care about me and to be loved. So at that point, I just didn't really know what to do.
Well, joining me now is Jeff Rogers, who is co-founder of the U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking. Jeff, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate you having me.
Well, this is incredibly heartbreaking, but it's a topic that is necessary to discuss because I think many of us, myself included, did not realize the scope of the problem. And not only that the problem is not strictly a global problem, because many of us, I believe, think that these individuals, these victims of trafficking, are transported across state and country lines. But in fact, it is a very local problem. So can you tell me a little bit about what you know in terms of the travel patterns of the individuals who are convicted, who are caught up in this sex trafficking ring?
Well, sure, absolutely. I'd be happy to. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you bringing attention to the fact that this is an American problem. It's happening in America. These are American kids. We identify well over 100,000 kids in America that are trafficked every day for sex. And as far as the patterns go, many of them could be trafficked in their own home city. Others, traffickers will take around the country, either by plane or more commonly through the interstate system, and go from state to state to state, depending upon major events that are taking place around the country. But just the fact to understand that these are American kids, and they're being purchased by American citizens, and they're being trafficked by American citizens. We have an American crisis taking place right now.
Well, I have a 15-year-old, a 12-year-old, and most compellingly, because I'm going to ask you about this now, a 10-year-old boy. And what I read in what you've written is that it's not just girls who are suffering, who are being brought into this horrific industry. You're documenting boys are also victims, and that's got to be major news for people who are listening today. So how bad is it for the boy side of this equation?
Well, of those kids that I mentioned that are trafficked, we found one DOJ-funded study that identified 36% of all trafficked kids in America are boys. And so even for those people that are aware that this is a problem inside the United States, very, very few people understand that it's a problem with boys being trafficked. And that's why at the U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking, we opened the very first boys' safe home in America for young boy victims of sex trafficking. We opened that in Florida 2 years ago.
Now, you talked about the fact in the piece that you wrote recently that you were quoted by a Christian Post reporter about the fact that many of these victims are actually, the male victims are dressed as little girls. Why are they dressed as girls before they're trafficked?
Well, I would say that happens. I wouldn't say it's a lot. It's not common. But I think it's, if we would identify why, it's to feed the needs of those individuals that want to purchase them for sex. And so that is highlighting the fact of the demand. And so what we recognize with sex trafficking is that it's a supply answer to a demand problem. And so the reason we have this problem is because there's the demand for the purchase of sex with adults and with children in our society, and that demand can only be met through sex trafficking. And so that's why you have circumstances like this, is because they're meeting the demand that's out there for this type of sex.
So help me understand some of these specifics. When you talk about kids who are being sold, is this for a one-time sexual encounter, or are these children being sold permanently into these underground lifestyles?
So what we find are that kids that are sold into the sex trafficking world are there many times for life. We find the average age of a lifespan for a child wrapped up in trafficking is only 7 years. And these kids are sold 1 to 5 to 10 up to 15. I mean, we've seen numbers way higher than that times per day that they are sold. And so it's truly a horrific lifestyle that they are stuck in, and most of them can truly find no way out.
Now, I read something that really made my stomach turn. And football, which the pinnacle of which every year is the Super Bowl, the penultimate American institution, right? Everyone has their favorite team. You've actually written that there's a market for sex trafficking during the Super Bowl. It would make sense to me, I suppose, if this were in Las Vegas or Los Angeles, because you've got, for example, the legality of prostitution. But the Super Bowl, where does that market come from?
Well, it comes from the demand. So you have a multitude of individuals gathering for a particular event somewhere in the country that is wrapped in supposed fun. And the things that they do when they get on the road are things such as buy sex. And so the Super Bowl has been identified as a major trafficking event. But I can share with you that other than the notoriety, there's really nothing more special about the Super Bowl than there are other major events or other major sporting events. What we find is basically that any major sporting event or any major event that occurs around the country, the sex trafficking would increase within that community around that event, whether it's certain sports or other types of events. So although there is significant attention given to the Super Bowl, I wouldn't identify it as extraordinarily unique when it comes to the spike that occurs surrounding that event with sex trafficking.
So you've talked about the sort of interrelation between large crowds of people and the opportunity for sex trafficking. But where are these other kids coming in from? Where are the other sites from which they're snatched?
Well, so what we do know is, and estimates vary on this, but 50 to 60 to 70% of the kids that are trafficked in America are coming out of the foster care system. So foster care really is the feeder system to meet that demand. And the reason is because you have highly vulnerable children, children that have grown up in an environment where they did not receive a tremendous amount of unconditional godly love in their household. And so they have low self-esteem. They're desiring love. And that is the number one way. And the young woman that you shared the clip on prior to our starting really described that, how there's this grooming period. And so traffickers are very skilled at being able to identify young, vulnerable children who are looking for love. And so with girls specifically, that trafficker will groom her for a period of maybe 6 to 9 months and act as their boyfriend, many times acting like an older boyfriend for that young girl. It's the first time she's ever had anybody pay attention to her, first time she's ever heard anybody say, I love you. And so she falls in love with him, thinking he's in love with her and thinking he's a boyfriend. But in fact, it's all part of the grooming period. And after that grooming period ends, he then flips a switch and says, okay, now you work for me. And at that point, she's beyond the point of no return, and she's now working for him.
Jeff, listening to her say in her own voice, I wanted a person to care about me and to be loved, so that at that point I didn't really know what to do. And she sounds so young. I'm a parent of kids in this age range, and I can hear the youth in her voice, and I can also hear the desperation, and it is absolutely heartbreaking. So you did something about it. Talk to me about the first safe home for young male trafficked victims that you opened.
Well, so Kevin Malone, the co-founder of the organization, and I got together and started the U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking. And the first program that we launched was to open the very first boys' safe home in America. And we did that because there were none. I mean, we were traveling the country, focusing on this problem, learning the magnitude of boys that are being trafficked for sex in America, and yet not being able to find services for boys. And so really, out of just the fact that it was necessary, we opened up this boys' safe home. And so we did that 2 years ago. It's a small residential facility. It's really just a home for these young kids. And it's specifically designed for kids age 10 to 17 here in the state of Florida. And for the first year and a half of operating the home, we were caring for 15, 16, 17-year-old boys. It wasn't until about 3.5 months ago, the story that you read, is when we received our first phone call for a 10-year-old boy. And I can share with you that as a staff, I mean, it was like a collective deep breath, and we just held our breath. I mean, we were licensed for this. We thought we had prepared for this. But then to actually face the reality of a young 10-year-old boy coming into this safe home, just the shocking reality of what's going on in our country just took us all to a whole new level. And I can share with you, 3 days ago, we've now gotten our first phone call for a 9-year-old boy. And so we've actually gone back to the state of Florida to revamp our licensing to receive younger than 10-year-old kids that have been trafficked for sex. It is unthinkable what's going on in our society. And it's only a reminder to us that, yes, we have to take care of these kids. We as a society have got to step up and take care of these kids. But what it does for us is it highlights the fact that there is a demand for purchased sex with very young kids in our society. And so we have got to get a grip on how we collectively, aggressively cut off the demand for this so we can stop it once and for all. One of the things we say is that, you know, there's a lot of social problems, obviously, that our country faces, whether it's homelessness or poverty or hunger or addiction or sex trafficking. And, you know, I'm not sure we can solve as a society every single one of them. But what we do stand on is that we should, as a society, be able to end the mass organized rape of our nation's kids for profit. We should be able to stop that one, and that's our commitment.
So tell me a little bit about the role that pornography plays in all of this. And you're not the only individual who has said this. Christine Kane, who is an evangelist, she's head of the anti-trafficking ministry, A21, has also mentioned the fact that pornography plays a role. So can you tie that together for us?
Absolutely. And obviously, Christine is a driving force in this industry. Much of what we've learned about the forces of pornography and the sex trafficking industry has come from our friends and partners at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation up in Washington, D.C. And so what we recognize is that pornography is the number one fueling factor for sex trafficking in America. And the reason is this. It is because individuals are looking at pornography. It's estimated maybe up to 70% of men in America are either addicted to or regularly looking at pornography, not understanding the true effects of it. Because what we have is what I call a downward spiral into depravity, where it's now being scientifically proven that pornography is just as physiologically addictive in the brain as major drugs. And so just like with a drug, the drug addict tries to achieve the same high but can't, and so they use more drugs or different types of drugs. The same thing is occurring with pornography, where the same type of pornography doesn't achieve the same level of arousal. And so what's happening is they're then going to more deviant, more violent, and younger pornography. And at a certain point in time, some of them want to then begin to actualize what they've been visualizing. And they can't find that naturally. And so then there becomes a market for purchased sex with kids. And that's really why we're finding the increase of this insatiable desire for sex with children, purchased sex with children in our society today. So we absolutely point to pornography as the number one driving factor for it.
Jeff, thank you so much for coming on, for bringing light to a very dark and very intense subject that must be considered by the body of Christ. You have been listening to Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website, at Sarah P. Perry, at T. Perkins. You've got the information. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.